Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me tonight, the Mrs. Hernandez to my Norma Romano, the Father Bra to my sister Jane, it's Jason.
Hey, good evening, Scott. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine. I wonder if some of our listeners were going, wait, Jason, where's Dan?
We took him off the masthead. He's done. He's lost in Colorado.
Yeah, Dan is currently on one of his vacations with his kids, touring several states in the southwestern region, if I recall. It had occurred to me that we've produced very little podcasts over the last couple months. I knew things were going to wind down to a certain extent after our last superhero one, when we did like the Flash finale and Arrow and all that kind of stuff. But unless I'm mistaken, I think we've only done one podcast since then, the Game of Thrones episode from like almost a month ago now, I think it was.
Yes, that's correct. And I wasn't part of that, so it's been since May since I've been on.
Well, yeah, but you know, you don't count. But
yeah.
But it kind of concerned me because I figured we should be getting some content out to folks who listen to us or subscribe to us. A lot of the reasons for that has been, you know, real life. You know, Dan is an extremely busy guy, you know, working a couple of jobs. And when he's not working, he's kayaking or he's hiking or he's spelunking or whatever it is he does. Like I said in our very first podcast a couple of years ago, he's the man of adventure. Meanwhile, at the same time, I've probably watched entirely too much TV. And since Dan hasn't gotten a chance to watch most of those shows, kind of been left, I can't do a podcast by myself. I would like to listen to that, but probably no one else would. So this week I decided to draft a couple of our compadres, who we usually do the geeky podcast with, to cover a bunch of shows in three different podcasts that we're going to record this week.
So, yeah, coming off the bench.
Yeah, and Jason, you're going to have to be like the power hitter this week, because we are actually going to be insane, and not only cover a bunch of different TV shows, but we're going to do it in two different podcasts. So I hope that your lips and tongue are not dry, because you will be doing some significant talking tonight.
Oh, man. I love to talk.
Oh, people are already turning off. Now, before I go any further, I should make it very clear, and I will probably say this at the outset of the other podcast I record this week as well. This will not be a spoiler-free podcast. We are going to be treating these shows as though you, the listeners, have already seen them. If we are talking about a show that you have not seen but would like to, just check out the segment breakdown that I do include with the podcast. You can see it, whether it's on Facebook or on our website or on iTunes. It's always there. And you can just skip that section if you want to hear the next one and so on. But I just want to make it clear, any TV show we're talking about it with the assumption you've already seen it. So we're not going to be worrying about spoiling people here. This will be a spoiler-filled podcast, and we may drop the occasional F-bomb as well, just because I feel like it.
Yeah, and if you feel like catching up, all these shows that we're doing are on Netflix.
Yes, all three of the shows we're doing. Actually, we're doing three shows tonight in this podcast, and then later this evening, although it might be morning by the time we get around to it, we're going to do another two shows, which are also on Netflix. So it's going to be a very Netflix-heavy podcasting week, because I think the other podcast I'm recording with our friend Cade is also a Netflix show. So it's all Netflix. These shows will just be Netflix podcasts, essentially.
It's Netflix week here.
Exactly.
Serious TV Drama Podcast.
Awesome. All right, so without any further ado, I think we should get to it. And the very first show we are going to be talking about is Orange is the New Black. Now, Orange is the New Black released their fourth season I guess it must have been about a month or two ago. I can't remember how long ago it got released at this point. Do you remember when?
It was on June 17th.
Okay, so it's been about a month. Okay. I've been a fan of the show from the outset. You know, when it first premiered, I was there like, oh, it's going to be like Oz, but with all women. And it was a little bit lighter than the HBO show Oz, which is one of my all-time favorites, by the way. But what I really find interesting about Orange is the New Black is the fact that although House of Cards is somewhat credited with it being Netflix's first major drama that, you know, really helped to usher in the binge show kind of phenomenon.
Oh, you're going to forget about Hemlock Grove? That show is awesome.
Yes, I am deliberately forgetting. But I think Orange is the New Black was really the show that brought binging more, made it an even bigger thing. Like, people were always, even with season four, where they were going to watch Orange is the New Black that weekend. People didn't. Whereas I think at this point with House of Cards, the last couple seasons, I know most people who watch it, they've taken their sweet ass time with that show. It doesn't quite have the, oh, I got to watch it all this weekend kind of feeling. Where Orange is the New Black has that addictive crack-like quality still. And maybe it's because they really have that really deft mix of drama, but with lightness as well. And I think it just, you know, you want to bounce to the next one, you know, over and over. It's a really good show in that sense.
Mm-hmm. And I think you could say that about all three of the shows we're doing tonight, that they're all pretty binge-worthy. But, yeah, I agree with your point about Orange. And Don't forget, last year, the season three, they even put it out early as a quote early release and surprise everybody.
That's probably why I got confused with when it was getting released this year, because it got released substantially earlier last year. That's probably what confused me. So let's talk about season four. That's what people are listening for. And I'm going to say right off the bat, instead of waiting until the end of the conversation, I'm kind of thinking this might be my favorite season of Orange is the New Black, which is really saying something. It also lends credence to my theory that more often than not, the fourth season of many dramatic shows or even comedies tends to be the best season. I really like this season a lot, and substantially more than the previous season, which I thought it kind of was lost its way for a good part of it and then got better in the back half. But this season I thought was very strong, juggling multiple storylines. Did you have a similar feeling, or how did you feel about it?
I thought the season came in behind the second season, but it was way ahead of the third season, which, as you said, it got lost, especially with Crazy Eyes' fan fiction novel that she was writing during that third season, which, you know, turned out to be ridiculous now, the way the show is taken in a big dramatic turn towards the end of season four.
Right. That storyline was a little bit on the silly side. It didn't really bother me, but it didn't really grab me either. Again, it's one of the difficult things with a show like this, because you do have storylines which can be really gripping and serious, and then you have the lighter ones. And that doesn't mean a lighter one can't be vastly entertaining and enjoyable. Of course it can be. That one, I felt, kind of ran a little bit longer than it felt it needed to. It really, they stretched out the whole Suzanne with the erotic fiction writing back in season three. So, although it certainly got referenced in season four, it didn't really play a part in it the way it did in season three.
Right.
Season two had been my favorite. It's between those two. I have my reasons why I now will pick season four ahead of it. I think that'll become clear as we talk about this season. So let's, right off the bat, let's take care of the orange elephant in the room when it comes to this show. I'm of the belief that most people who watch this show are not fans of the character that was meant to be the main character, Piper. I've not really liked Piper from season one on. I've never cared for the character very much. I don't hate her, but I always found her less interesting than almost anybody else on the show. I mean, I know she's doing that thing where she's supposed to stand in for us. She's kind of like the Beecher on Oz was. Only the Oz fans will get that reference, of course. But she's so abhorrently selfish and self-centered always. I just always found her tiresome. But I thought they used that this season. I thought the show was conscious of that and really used that to great effect this season. So this is the first, you know?
I thought even the inmates were tired of her crap this year.
I think it was almost a meta kind of thing on the show where there were comments made about no one likes her. And I thought that was also a commentary on the viewers, the fans, that we don't like her. And when you're watching the season, that first half of the season, with each successive episode, she becomes more and more unlikable.
Extremely.
Yeah, and usually when we talk about a character becoming unlikable, it's because they're becoming like a quote-unquote villain. You know, it's, people are starting not to like Walter White because he's becoming more and more a bad guy. With her, I know she believed herself to becoming a bad person, a bad guy, though no one else did. I think she's just became more annoying and just irritating, quite frankly.
Yeah, every time she tried to be a badass, she was checked by somebody.
But the genius of it is what ends up happening to her, I think, is kind of like a slap in the face to the viewer as well, just to remind us of what kind of people she's dealing with. And it's an amazing moment because as much as we didn't like her, you do feel for her in that scene. You know what the scene I'm talking about, of course.
Yeah, where she gets branded with a swastika.
Yeah, which also is, speaking of Oz references, that also happened to Beecher in the first season of Oz. First episode, in fact, if I'm not mistaken.
Schillinger did it to him.
That's right, except he did it in a less prominent area, if I recall. I think he did it to his ass, if I'm not mistaken. But what I liked about that is that they took a character we already didn't like. They said, okay, you don't like her? You know, we're going to make sure you don't like her, and now we're going to test you. And I don't know anyone who watched the show who didn't kind of recoil at that scene, because they stuck with it. It was kind of unflinching, and the effect it had on her. So I think it ends up working really well for the show and for the season. And I liked her more post-swastika, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things where you know this is a permanent scar. And there's no getting this off.
Right.
You know, they did end up covering it, but at the time, you don't know what's going to happen to her because, you know, that thing's on her forever.
Right. And what's interesting is that she's still, although she's ends up being responsible for a lot of the shit that happens in the season, like, well, obviously, her unintentionally forming, you know, a white power hate group in the prison or whatever. She's kind of like a side character to bigger stories, if that makes any sense. She's not the center of them. She's kind of just, you know, on the peripheral of them. Like the stuff with Alex.
Right.
That, I mean, that's kind of a much bigger story that's, you know, throughout the entire season. The fact that the hitman who was disguised as a guard there tried to kill her. And then we first think Lolly killed him. And then when Alex goes to check out the body. Is she going to the body to prepare to help bury him? I can't remember why she goes to see the body.
Yeah, she's going to go get rid of the body.
Right. Anyway, there's a realization that somehow he's still alive. So she actually has to murder the guy, which has a devastating effect on her as well. But I really loved that plot line because it had the ticking bomb effect. Lolly is the ticking bomb this season, for a good part of the season, because you don't know when she's going to fucking go bonkers and basically spill everything. And if I'm not mistaken, she kind of sort of does spill everything, doesn't she?
She does, and Healy does not listen to her. He thinks she's just kidding.
Healy is another...
It's a delusion.
Yeah. He's a very interesting character because so much of the time he's been portrayed as this unlikable buffoon. And then he has these moments of real poignancy and you really feel bad for the guy. When you know, it's interesting. As you go back to the earlier seasons, he comes off far more ignorant. You know, I mean, he still has that to a certain extent. It's not like he suddenly had a total conversion. But it's interesting, they definitely make him a much more sympathetic character in the last two seasons than he was in the first two, as far as I can recall.
Right, and his first, you know, his big moment in the first season was locking Piper in the yard with a crazy person.
That's right, I forgot. That's right, he's responsible for that. Bad man. But getting back to the Alex and Lolly stuff, by the way, I thought Lori Petty's playing a character which could be very easily, instantly irritating.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
I personally thought she did a really good job with it because there was something very convincing about her portrayal at a certain point. And it was very different than what we envisioned that character was in the previous season. So I like that there was kind of a shift with her character where I think, I mean, am I wrong? In season three, don't we kind of think she's there as potentially the person who's there to kill Alex?
Yes. Mm-hmm. She's a plant.
And now it just turns out she's a little crazy.
She's just a loony person.
But I thought she was really, especially in her later episodes, really exceptional. I really did a good job. You know, I always liked Lori Petty, but I thought she really did quite a number in this season.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And that storyline also featured one of those really more lesser focused on inmates. I admit I had to look up her name before the podcast because all I can remember is, oh, the old lady with the spider tattoo on her neck. Frida is her name. I love that character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have really dug out a lot of flashbacks for some of the more obscure characters on the show. I am dying to see her flashback. Because she keeps hinting about all these weird, horrible things she's done in her life. It's like, that's the flashback I want. You know, if they could give us a Rosa flashback, you know, a couple seasons. Was it last season? No, second season, right? Second season.
I think it was the second season, yeah.
Yeah, because she runs over V at the end of it. So, yeah, it had to be second season. You know, I love the idea of giving us flashbacks for these considerably older characters because they probably do a better job of casting younger versions of characters on Orange is the New Black than most any other show I've seen, other than maybe Boardwalk Empire, perhaps, which I'll be talking about a little bit on another podcast. Anyway, like the actress they had playing the late teens version of Lolly, what really looked like her, I thought.
It did. It looked like her, and it sounded a lot like her, too.
And definitely one of the more heartbreaking storylines, and as well as flashback stories as well. You got a number of flashbacks this season where it's like, oh, it's horrible. It's just sad. You just feel bad that they're even incarcerated for whatever reason. You know, Lolly obviously is one. Suzanne is another one who we'll be getting to in a minute or two, I'm sure. That's the puzzling one, why she's is where she is considering what she's in trouble got in trouble for. But back to Lolly, I'd say one of the more heartbreaking moments of the entire season is when she's led away to the psych ward.
Yes. Yeah, when she's going screaming down the hall.
And is it Healy she's calling out to? Is that the person?
I believe so. Mm-hmm.
You know what it reminded me of a little bit? Did you watch The Wire? You watched The Wire.
Oh, of course. That's okay. My favorite show.
Okay. Then you probably already know where I'm going with this. And also
it's the Where's Wallace, right?
I'm going to season four again.
Oh, okay.
Remember, I always say best season of Wire, season four. Uh-huh. The moment where one of the four kids, I always forget I forget his name. The kid who was selling the candy at school always kind
Randy.
Of Randy.
Randy.
Randy. When he's led away down the hallway and he's calling back out after the cop, you know,
Carver. He's calling Carver.
Carver, you know, are you going to help me now? Whatever. That's just heartbreaking because, you know, he's going into the system and, you know, like this is it. His life is now shot. And I thought, oh, this is kind of a weird parallel to that. And it actually even happens episode-wise in probably in a similar episode number. I'm not sure. I should look that up, but I find that to be an interesting parallel. So, yay for me. Well, since I mentioned Suzanne, storyline-wise, she kind of plays it on the sidelines a lot this season. I know she has that weird thing with the girl who was really into her, who she had, what was her name? Kukudio, I think her name was, or something like
that. I can't remember her name.
Well, Chico was like really into her porn fiction, whatever the fuck it was, sci-fi porn stuff she was writing. And, you know, I don't really want to get too much into that storyline until much later, but Suzanne's flashback, you remember her flashback, right?
Yeah, are you talking about for one this season?
Yeah, in this season.
Where she takes the boy home?
Right. Now, here's the big, to me, one of the top three mysteries of the show, maybe not just this season, but overall now, because there's always been mysteries about, Suzanne though, is always the most mysterious character, because when we glimpsed of who her parents apparently were, it's like, wait, what's the story here? You know, how did this happen? How did she end up in this situation? All that stuff. And now we see her in this flashback, and she's essentially like a Walmart greeter or something. And she's friends with that little kid who she meets on the playground that ends up taking him home. And he kind of freaks out, and it starts to have the appearance as though she had kidnapped him or something, even though she clearly that wasn't what she thought she had done. And then the kid tries to run away from her and falls from her window.
Right.
With the implication is he died. I mean, because she's not like she's on like the second floor, it doesn't look like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How was she only in a very minimum security facility at this rate?
That's a good question. The only thing I can think of is, even though it's a pretty high height, is that maybe the kid didn't die. Maybe, as they would say, in Holy Grail, he was just really badly hurt.
But even so, if she was incarcerated, that means at the very least they believed her to have kidnapped this kid, even if she didn't mean to, that's the way it came off, and had, you know, indirectly caused harm to him. You know, even if he didn't die, and I still kind of think the kid died from just the way she was looking. Because, you know, it's not like she stopped and ran back downstairs. She was just staring at him.
Mm-hmm.
You go somewhere a bit worse than that. You either end up in maximum security, or you're in an institution if they just determine that she's crazy. Which, quite frankly, is really where it always seems like is where she should be. You know, I mean, she's a sweet character and she's interesting and she has her moments. But as we see even in this season, yeah, but I think maybe
she's dangerous. She can be dangerous.
You know? And quite frankly, when we get to the big thing, I mean, she bears a big, it's not really spoken about as much, but she bears a huge chunk of the responsibility for the horrible climax of the season, quite frankly. But we'll, you know what? Let's just fucking get to it now. why delay it? Confession for the few people out there who don't know this, who don't follow me on Facebook or whatever. I got spoiled on this season. It was my own fault. I had put up some threads for the show on a couple different Facebook pages. Although I hadn't watched the show yet, and my eyes caught a comment on one of those threads, which revealed the biggest spoiler of the season, which was what happens with Poussey's character. So that was unfortunate. I found out about that, and I was maybe two episodes in.
Wow. So that was pretty quick.
So I had to spend the rest of my viewing of the show waiting for it to happen. I didn't know what episode was going to happen. And after every episode that went by, I grew more and more concerned because I kept thinking the later it happens, the worse it's going to be. The bigger mm-hmm. deal it's going to be. And please don't tell me I got spoiled on the biggest thing of the series. And yes, that's what it turned out to be, pretty much, when it doesn't happen until towards the end of episode 12. That was really something.
Yeah, it was. And the flashback was going on, too, of her, and you didn't know quite what was going on there, or what time, what particular time that took. But, you know, it could have gone either way, as fan theories go, is like maybe that was not really a flashback, but maybe that was her dying.
Are you talking about what they did in the final episode? Because the final episode has Poussey with her perfect night in the city after she's dead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm thinking of the wrong episode.
Yeah. The flashback in episode 12, I think, is for Bailey.
Bailey, yeah. Okay.
The guard. What makes that work so well is she was the inmate who probably had not just the most hope, but the most to look forward to, who clearly had a light, was about to have a life outside of this prison.
Yeah.
She had it all set up with Judy King. The wonderful little Blair Brown character we had this season was kind of like the Martha Stewart
Paula Deen.
She acted like Paula Deen, but there were certain Martha Stewart qualities. And the fact that she was incarcerated was very much following the Martha Stewart storyline from real life as well. But anyway, back to Poussey. So it was fascinating what they did. They took the character that it would be most painful to see that happen to, because she was one of the most pure characters on the show, yet never annoying about it, unlike, say, maybe her girlfriend, So-So, who could be kind of annoying. And then of all the guards, pretty much almost all of them were bad to horrible people. The one guy who might have actually not only been decent, it had also been indicated he shouldn't even be doing this job. He should leave and get another job. So having those two pieces in motion and it happened just made it just like tripled the tragedy of it, I thought.
Yeah. And it turned out, that Bailey was not a bad guy. He was just put in a bad spot. And, it was a terrible accident for him. He didn't mean to do it, but it happened anyway. And now he had to deal with the consequences after that. And I just always thought of him as just like a big goof of a character most of the season.
Well, that's kind of an interesting thing with this show, is that they can take a character that does seem to be just kind of like a goofy character or silly, and then they'll reveal something about the character to show a darker side or a more serious side, or they'll just use it in a much more character in a much different serious way. There's a lot of interesting character evolution on this show. If you can think about how different so many characters are now when you look at them as compared to, say, season one, like Lorna, for example, or Pensatucky, for example, is probably the best example, quite frankly, or even Big Boo,
Daya.
There's a lot of characters, and that's probably what makes this show as good as it is that you. There is significant character development with these characters. Bailey, we didn't really get to know for that long a period of time, which is probably why it was good that they gave us a kind of a flashback, that he's kind of this young goofball who sort of kind of just fell into the job. It wasn't like it was something, it was his life's work or dedication or something his dad did or anything like that. So, but what happens is the death happens when he's has Poussey down on the ground, and he's in the middle of trying to cuff her. I'm thinking, and then Suzanne attacks him.
Mm-hmm.
So Suzanne's on top of him when he's on top of her. So he's fighting off Suzanne without realizing. At the same time, he's crushing Poussey. So that's what I'm saying. Like I found it interesting that. It kept coming down to Bailey accidentally killed Poussey. I was like, yeah, he did. But Suzanne, I know she has guilt about it. She should. In fact, she should probably have more guilt about it, because all she was doing was practicing how it would feel to be crushed, you know, after that, if I recall.
Yes, she was. She's putting books on herself in the bed.
But, I mean, that was a really powerful episode overall. And I remember I mentioned this online. I discovered shortly after the fact that Matthew Weiner directed it, which was amazing to me, for anyone who doesn't know who that is. He's the creator and main writer for Mad Men. And this is actually the first thing he's done since Mad Men ended, was direct this episode. So that, I have to say, that has to add a little bit of something to the episode when you go out and you get that guy to direct an episode of something. You know, next year it'll be like Vince Gilligan directs an episode or something, I'm sure. Because he's absolutely on that level, if not higher, quite frankly.
Right. And I did not know that until I read that from you.
But, I mean, this is a show that, unlike, say, Oz, which took place with more serious, hardened criminals, I mean, pretty much all killers of one form or another. these are people who are serving sentences for slightly lesser crimes, so they're not all, you know, cold-blooded murderers and killers and rapists or something like Oz was. So we don't get as many character deaths on this show as you did on Oz. You didn't get an episode where at least one character didn't die. That was just the nature of that show.
Oh, they were bumping regulars off all the time on that show.
Oh, and even or get or so I think someone dies on every episode of Oz. It could be a guest, someone who's only in that one episode. But pretty much, I don't know if there's an episode of Oz where at least one character doesn't die per episode, which is why you can't take it too seriously, because there could be no prison in the world that could possibly function with that kind of a death rate. With Orange is the New Black, I don't recall if we've seen that many characters pass away on the show.
We had the one girl that overdosed in season one.
Right, I remember that. And I think...
V escaped and then she got run over. Yeah. That doesn't really count.
Sort of, but it's still on prison ground. Well, no, I guess it was too far away. It was down the road or whatever. Again,
the prison guard, the fake prison guard, the hitman,
right?
This year,
but it's something we don't see very often. Usually, the harshest thing that happens to someone is they get beaten or they get put in the shoe. The shoe is like near death for characters on this show, you know.
Sent down the hill too.
Yeah, sent down the hill like Nikki did, or they go into psych like Lolly, and I guess. Was by the end of the season, is Suzanne going to psych? Wasn't that the implication, or did she not go? I don't remember.
I don't remember either.
I'm glad we're talking about a show, and I don't remember.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I thought they did a really great job with that, and that's like the penultimate episode of the season. And then you get the final episode, which, you know, the tensions are being ratcheted up, with the potential for rioting. And then you get Caputo, who I always enjoy Caputo's character on the show. He's the eternal guy caught between a rock and a hard place. I think he always wants to do the right thing, but he often, although meaning well, doesn't quite pull it off, you know?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And it's what he's doing the press conference. And I think it's because Tasty overhears the press conference. And even though the company they work for, I think it's MCC, basically wants him to paint Bailey as this out-of-control correctional guard, just basically pin the whole thing on him, he kind of sticks up for him. He never mentions anything about Pousse by name or says anything positive about her, when she's like the true innocent here. And that's essentially what triggers the riot, I think, right?
It does. It's because they feel like that Pousse is being ignored.
Yeah.
As Tasty says, say her name, as they start the riot.
Right, right, right. And which I thought, I mean, the writing I thought was fantastic. I thought it's a great idea, it's a great culmination in a season that was filled with tension between the guards and the prisoners, because the guards do some really fucked up things this season. I mean, there's that one guard, Humphrey, who may be one of the sickest fucks we've had on the show.
Yes. Yeah, it makes you long for Pornstache to come back.
Oh, yeah. Pornstache is like just a big lovable cartoon character compared to some of these guys. I mean, that guy specifically, he's out of control with what he does with one of the Latina girls. What's her name? It begins with a letter M.
Maritska?
Yeah. When he actually, he overhears her talking in one episode about like discussing things, which you'd rather, it's almost like something out of Fear Factor. Would you rather eat like a baby mouse or what was it, like some sort of bug or something?
It was 10 dead flies or swallow one baby mouse.
Right. And he, with a gun to her head, he makes her do it, which is, thankfully we don't see it, but it still works as being just a horrific thing. And then later he actually forces inmates to fight each other.
Yeah, you know, that's where Crazy Eyes goes off again.
Right, and beats the living crap out of, basically out of her girlfriend, or semi-girlfriend, or supposed ex-girlfriend. I don't even know what they'll call her.
Yeah, correct.
But the point is, and again, that's kind of why I'm getting to the point of why I really like the season so much, is because these dramatic tensions that are being set up weren't confined to only a couple key characters. Like in season two, it was V taking over. But a lot of that conflict was like between V and Red and within V's own ranks. Whereas this season, it's affecting everybody. It's all the prisoners and the guards are out of control. And it's also especially and scarily timely, having the situations that are going on in this prison and what's been going on in the real world over the last year or so definitely is playing a part in this. I mean, obviously not more recent events, that's not possible, but if you think about stuff that even happened last year in the news, if you don't think that didn't inform some of the writing for this season, you're watching a different show, because I'm absolutely sure it did.
I'm sure it did too, and you could see it coming out in the last episode. It had echoes of Ferguson and other things that have gone on.
Absolutely. Now, it leads to probably one of the only things I'm a little iffy on for the entire season. And it's odd for, of all things for me to be have any issue with, it's pretty much the last thing that happens. That gun ending up in the hands of
I think it's Daya, Dayanara.
Dayanara is her full name, but Daya is probably an easier way to say it. I should have just went with that. You know, at least I didn't call her Khaleesi. Anyway. But for her to be the one with the gun in her hand, I don't know.
Didn't make a lot of sense to me.
Didn't make sense. I mean, because she really didn't have much to do with most of the storylines this season. She had her bigger storylines in previous seasons with the pregnancy. See, with the correctional guard who mysteriously has disappeared. We've never heard from him again.
Went to ABC. He went to ABC.
There you go. That makes perfect sense. Another one of those deals. I know there was a thing earlier in the season because her mother was getting out and was concerned that she was, concerned that she might get involved with the wrong people, with the other Latina group, Maria Ruiz, who is now taking over power there with Blanca and all those people. And we see Gloria being concerned about her hanging out with them. That always felt a little bit false to me, because Daya seems like she'd be more savvy than that.
Right.
And she wouldn't fall in with these people. She would know better.
She doesn't seem like much of a follower. She seems more like a leader.
Yeah, but she also seems to be more of a, for lack of a better way to put it, she's more of a free spirit. I mean, she's an artist. I mean, she draws things. She's different than they are. Mm-hmm. So I have never gotten the impression that she longs to belong in a specific clique or group or something. I mean, and quite frankly, she didn't get along with her mother most of the time she was in there. So I don't buy that, oh, now that her mother's not there, she needs someone to gravitate to. It's like, no, you and your mother were getting along for what, the last month? Just they had more fights than they ever had, any sweet moments, quite frankly. So anyway, the point being, it's like, oh, so this is showing that how she really has gone down the wrong road because she's the one who ends up with the gun. And I'm like, really? That kind of doesn't work. I think they kind of shied away from what it felt like it should have been. And let's be honest, I hate to say it, I feel like that gun should have ended up in the hands of a black woman. Not one of the Latinas, and certainly not a white person. I felt it should have ended up in Tasty's hand, maybe. That would have made way more sense, especially considering it was her. She was the one who was most affected by the loss of Poussey, so that would have had a much more powerful effect. That would have made more... And, and I could probably name like a half a dozen other people. It would have been more interesting. But Daya was like, really? Her? Eh. So I'm curious why they went that route. I'd love to find out. They probably didn't do this. I would love to think that this is like the old days of TV and they filmed like, six other people getting the gun and doing that as well.
To me, it just sort of seemed like they just gave it to her to have her something for next year.
Yeah.
They set up something for her for next year. What's going to happen after that?
It just came off a little bit on the lame side for me. But, it didn't ruin the episode. It just made me kind of go, her? It's like I was watching Arrested Development or something. Only the Arrested Development fans will get that joke. Everyone else will be like, okay.
I got it.
I know you. I'm very happy we're podcasting together because you got that joke. The only other thing I would want to personally mention about the season, which was an interesting thing to watch, let's go back to Pensatucky. First of all, oh, by the way, I'll say right now, I never imagined saying this the first couple seasons, but my favorite stuff to watch on the show, character-wise, tends to be the Pensatucky / Big Boo scenes. That's become my favorite characters to watch interact with each other more than anybody else. Maybe because they're the most different characters who are with each other. They're not with each other, of course, haha. But you know what I mean, right?
Yeah. It certainly seemed like they had more to do last year than they did this year. Pensatucky and Big Boo seem to have taken on the sidelines this season.
Up to a point, obviously, because last season, and what probably one of the things that was most memorable last season was the rape storyline with Pensatucky and I actually had to look up his name, the guardian.
Donuts,
right. Coats, but Donuts, let's call him Donuts. But it was a very interesting choice because they played enough of a part this season because she was getting to the point of wanting to talk to him, wanting to forgive him, and Big Boo had a really big issue with her doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked the way that was handled because that's as touchy as the rape stuff was last season. And they handled it so well compared to Game of Thrones or something like that, or Downton Abbey or something. Orange is the New Black did a much better job of it. Maybe because almost everyone behind the scenes are women, who wrote the episode and everything, including this whole storyline. These are women who wrote this. This isn't like some male fantasy. Let's just forgive the rapists. These are women writing this. So I gotta, give them the benefit of that they know what they're doing. But then as that storyline unfolds, by the end of it, you kind of get it. And it's weird, but it works. And I give it all the credit in the world because I didn't expect it. I would not have expected them to do that. It was very – so I thought that was one of the riskier things they certainly did this season. And this show does take risks, absolutely. And it's an interesting point of debate for people because I'm sure there are people who watched it and didn't like that they did that. They felt, dude, rapist, he should pay some horrible penalty. They should have stuffed something up his ass after all. Whatever. I love that he finds out that they actually almost did it. But I thought that was really an interesting storyline, because I thought it challenged the viewer, because the more we saw of him, he wasn't as unlikable as I think we want him to be.
Right. They did a good job of humanizing him.
Yeah, and whether we choose to forgive him or not is irrelevant, but Pennsylvania has her reasons, and she articulates them pretty well, I think. So it was an interesting storyline. So like I said, yeah, they weren't a focus of the season the way it was in season 3, but I still think it played a significant enough part because it certainly was memorable. I mean, there were certain characters who kind of just disappeared this season, you know.
Yes.
You know, who had very little, you know, like Norma, there was a huge storyline about her like in the last season or whatever, but she kind of disappears. You know, the sister, the nun, other than going to solitary to check on Sophia, pretty much plays no part other than hiding a cell phone up her cooch.
Mm-hmm.
Even Sophia.
She didn't get a whole lot to do either, except just, you know, where Sophia seemed to be a big thrust of the storyline for the first part of the year.
And, you know, you kind of wonder, at one point, I was like, is she off filming other shows, and that's why they did the storyline this way, so we don't even have to see her most of the time? I mean, because that actually happened, coincidentally, on Oz, where there was a character who kept ending up in solitary, and sometimes we didn't hardly ever see him, and a lot of that was because that was a character, the actor Kurt Acevedo.
Yeah, it's Alvarez.
Alvarez. That would happen, and we might hear him, but we wouldn't see him for a long stretch. It's like, yeah, you know why? Because he's filming other stuff. So,
yeah, I think at one point it was for Band of Brothers is where he went off the film.
I think you're right. Oh, look at you with the HBO knowledge. But and speaking of Sophia, and that might be a lot. I think it's almost unfortunate because, you know, obviously with transgender stuff being such a huge thing in the news and so pervasive in our culture now, it seemed interesting that as big a part as it played last season, they kind of did hardly anything with it. Because she was kept in solitary for almost the entire season. I think she gets out in the last couple episodes and that's about it.
Right. She takes over the beauty shop back.
Yeah. So, I mean, I didn't hate it. I was just like, oh, okay. I kind of wish she had been able to do more with her. But, you know, it's one of those things when you dealing with a show that has that many characters and you're juggling that many storylines, some are just going to end up having more weight than others.
Mm-hmm. I know you hate digression, but I was just thinking about the Pennsylvania character. She was actually the character that got locked in with Piper in season 1 that Haney did. She goes from that kind of character to where she is now, the big change.
Oh yeah, I mentioned it before. Yeah, I think Pennsylvania is the biggest change of any character on the show. Pennsylvania goes from a character that most viewers, she was like the love to hate character. She was vile. She was horrible. She was nasty. She was violent. Every word that came out of her was just, you know, nails on a chalkboard, annoying and horrible. And now she's become probably one of the most sympathetic characters on the show. And kind of weirdly, even more weird than that, one of the sweetest characters on the show. Very strange. But they pulled it off. I give them, the writers and the actress, all the credit in the world. I think when I talked about this show like a year ago, I credited her as being like, kind of like the MVP of the show that season, because I thought she turned in the most significant and most important performance in season 3. I don't know who I would say. I got to think who I would say that about this season. That's interesting.
Who do you MVP. Think? MVP.
Yeah. Who do you think would be like the standout of the season?
Ooh, that is a good question. I think maybe Caputo, just by the way that he's wants to do the right thing, but he's always put up against the wall by outside forces.
That's not a bad choice. I don't know. That's a good one. I'm kind
of especially or the captain of the guard, which I found like it'd be an interesting, fascinating character.
Piscatella.
Yeah.
I found him interesting as a villain. I wasn't sure if I quite believed him as much as other characters, because he was he wasn't quite twirling a mustache, but he was kind of really close, if you know what I mean. I mean, yeah, uh-huh. I mean, just dropping the fact that, oh, he happens to be gay, like, yeah, that doesn't mean anything to me. That means nothing. It's like The Wire revealing that a certain character was gay in one episode, but it never plays any part in it. It's just like, oh, by the way, he's a hard ass, he's also gay. Just to show you that gay people can be that way too. Yeah, we know that. We're not stupid. You know, that's a good choice, and it probably, but you know who I'm probably going to pick out of all people? I find it interesting when a character comes out of nowhere. Because on this show, you always think about all the obvious ones, you know, your Pipers, your Tasties, Daya, whoever. Maria kind of came out of nowhere. I actually had to go back and look at, like, oh, she's been on the show all this time. I didn't even remember her barely. And she ends up playing a huge part this season. Huge part. Convincing in her flashback, plays a big part, you know, shifts from being someone who is almost being set up as a villain to an ally. I might actually go with her because I wouldn't have even remembered her before season four. So she kind of came out of nowhere. So that might be my choice.
That's a good choice. I like it.
All right. If that's everything I think I can think of to talk about Orange is the New Black, unless there's anything we've neglected, can you think of anything?
Other than miss the old prison guards, even though you saw them appear throughout the season.
I kept wondering how much they got paid for the season, since they're in it so little.
Right.
And also give them credit, because I kept thinking somehow by the end of the season he's going to go out and have hired them all back.
And it didn't happen.
It didn't happen. It doesn't mean it might not happen next season somehow. But that, and maybe that would have been the more conventional choice that we were expecting. That we've seen where they all are. He's run into at least one of them. That's what's going to end up happening. They didn't do that. So, again, I give them a lot of credit for not going the obvious route that I might have chosen myself. So good right. for you, Orange is the New Black. This definitely a rebound from season three, which was not bad, but this was far and away a much better season. And, you know, like I said, I might pick it as my favorite. You like season two better. Season two was my favorite, so I can totally see picking that one as well.
Yep.
All right. So
let's put a wrap on that one.
Let's switch to a different Netflix show. Quite different, in fact. We're going to now start talking about The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Fascinating transition.
Now, this was the second season of Kimmy Schmidt, and I'll confess I just recently watched all of them, so it's fairly fresh in my mind. Did you watch it when it first got released, Jason?
Yes, I did. Way back in April.
Oh my god, alright. No, you watched it when a lot of people did. I watch it like people who have lives do, and I don't have a life. It just worked out that way. I kept starting it, and then Netflix would release another new drama. Like, oh, I gotta watch this. Oh, I gotta watch Happy Valley. Oh, I gotta watch Peaky. Oh, I gotta watch whatever the hell I have to watch. So, but finally, I did get around to going through all of them within the last week or so. I really liked it. I would say, in some ways, it's on par with season one. There are some things in season one I like better. There are some things in this season I like better. I don't even know if I have a clear... I probably like season one a little bit better, only because there's more John Hamm. You know? But that's probably not really fair to the rest of the show. But I'll tell you right off the bat one of the reasons I really like this season. I have never liked Jane Krakowski's characters on these Tina Fey shows. On 30 Rock, I never liked her character. I found her annoying. She could be funny from time to time, but generally speaking, I just didn't like her. And I didn't like her in season one of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt either.
Yeah, she was really awful in the first season.
But I liked her this season. I really and I realize it's because they knocked her character down any number of pegs and thus made it easier to relate or sympathize. And or just maybe they just gave her a better storyline that wasn't as insane as her storylines tend to be. But I really enjoyed her character and her storylines a lot this season.
Yeah. I think the most insane storyline they have is making her be Native American, which is crazy.
It's just but you gotta hand it to them. The fact that they planted that, you know, back in season one, that's her heritage, that's where she's from. So they could build all the way up to that Washington Redskins joke. Once they reveal that. I mean, first, I was so thrilled when, and we're talking about the character, the lawyer, Russ Snyder. Is it Snyder? Russ Snyder, played by David Cross, which automatically made me go, oh boy, David Cross, because I'm a big Bob and David fan, whatever. But then we meet his family, and the fact that one of his brothers is Josh Charles, who I love from The Good Wife and Sports Night, whatever. When it's revealed that they're the owners of the Washington Redskins. Oh, I was just so thrilled with the ballsy nature of doing that. It was just so goofy. That made me laugh out loud, most definitely.
Yeah, it was a big lead up for that one joke.
But back to just the general premise of the show, it's interesting that our first show we talked about tonight was Orange is the New Black, which is a drama slash comedy, dramedy, you know, however you want to look at it. And the other shows we're talking about are obviously more in the comedy vein, and thus you'd think, therefore, are lighter shows. But this show, and then the next show we're going to talk about, if you just look at, like, the log line of the show, what the show is about, it's kind of fucking dark.
Yes, it is. It really is.
Because, you know, Kimmy Schmidt, we're dealing with someone who's a survivor. And everyone chooses to focus on the fact that she was, you know, kept captive as part of this little mini cult for, what is it, 15 years, they say?
Yeah, it was for 15 years. Okay. In a bunker.
Now there is, I believe that it finally is said in one or maybe two lines a season, but the obvious implication has always been, well, you know what was happening down in that bunker. There's a reason why he kept, you know, three or four sister wives down there. He wasn't just playing cards with them. So that's some pretty dark shit.
It's really dark, and it bubbles up towards the end of the year.
Yeah, and so what's interesting about this season, because the first season was more about a very surface-level thing. It's about how does a woman, you know, adjust to normal life and then has to deal with the trial. This season, she's quote unquote seems to have adjusted to normal life, but now it's like now she really has to deal with what happened to her and the fact is she has suppressed so much of it and just not really dealt with it. And the only way it's coming up in her is through her belching, quite frankly. But she's a character who's never angry. She never gets upset. She never gets truly angry or mad at anybody, and that becomes a big issue this season when she finally, you know, has to let her emotions take over and finally show anger for the first time.
And boy, does she ever! She really lets loose.
But I just found and like I said, that's kind of one of the things that really makes the season fascinating for me because it's trickier than what they did in the first season. So it becomes just a bit more of a subtle thing. And one of the ways she's doing this is because she's finally seeing a therapist. And can we talk about Tina Fey for a minute here? Obviously, this is Tina Fey's show. She co-produced and co-wrote this with, what's his name, Robert, I didn't write it down, Carlock.
Yeah, Robert Carlock.
You know, who, again, wrote a lot of 30 Rock and as well as produced it and other TV shows as well. I didn't really care for her very much in season one when she was just doing a silly riff on Marcia Clark. It was just very goofy. You know, she plays a more of a quote unquote real character this season. And the fact that she's playing a psychiatrist who gets so entirely wasted, she becomes like an entirely different personality at night. I loved all that stuff. I thought that stuff was comedy gold.
I thought it was brilliant. It was a nice character and really much different than the first season, which was, I just thought it was awful. I didn't care for that whole storyline, that whole trial storyline, just because of Tina Fey and the other guy.
I love John Hamm so much in the trial scenes. It made me ignore everything else, so I didn't care. Because you have to remember, when I'm watching that, I'm fresh off of watching the final season of Mad Men. So you already got me. Oh, by the way, did you catch the... Okay, my two favorite things in Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt this season. Number one, the Mad Men reference they make, I adored. Do you remember, remember the line where...
Well, they talks about he came up with Coke.
He came up with the I'd like to buy the world a Coke commercial. Which, another spoiler, is kind of, that's what happens in Mad Men. So that was awesome. But back to Tina Fey, the thing that made me laugh the most of all, and there's a lot of stuff that made me laugh this season, is when nighttime drunky version of the therapist gives Kimmy a sealed envelope, a message to give the daytime version. And she opens the envelope. It turns out all she did was fart in the envelope. The show likes to make fart jokes. And I've never seen a show, movie or a TV show, make quite as many fart jokes, but without one fart noise. They just make references to farts all the time. And I don't care how old I am, fart jokes are eternal. They will always make me laugh. I could be 4, I could be 40, I could be 94. They will always make me laugh. So thank you, Tina Fey, for that. Other than that, I mean, as I watched the season, I kept wondering... early on, I'm hoping John Hamm was going to show up again because, as I've already mentioned, kind of a fan. I like that for most of the season, even when the character of Reverend Wayne Gary Wayne would show up, they do it in a way where you couldn't ever see clearly that it was John Hamm.
Yeah, it was always in shadows.
He was either in shadows or when they did the thing where they reversed like the mouth and eyes. But at a certain point you realize that's what they're doing, that they keep messing with us, whether he's the guy in the van or the guy approaching, and there's a reason for that, because we never know if it's actually him and maybe they just recorded his voice. I thought it was very clear that they were doing that on purpose, so that when you get to the very last episode, the last minute of the episode, we actually see him clearly for the first time. And I realized, oh, that's why you did it all the whole season. I don't know if he needed to do that, but fine. I thought it was kind of funny that they did it that way.
It was just an artistic choice on their part.
I love that Lisa Kudrow was her mom. I thought that was a fine piece of casting.
Yes. Like more like a 80s hippie mom, right? If I remember correctly.
Yeah, her mom was Lorianne, who spends all her days riding roller coasters. So... So they have their entire breakthrough conversation in dealing with their emotions and how her mother hasn't ever dealt with stuff on a roller coaster. So that must have been a lot of fun, and I mean that sarcastically for them, to film, because it really didn't look like Ellie Kemper liked it. I mean, her character didn't like it. I didn't get the impression that the actress liked it either. I mean, she probably was feeling kind of sick after a certain point.
Yeah, because who knows how many times I rode that roller coaster. over and over and over again.
But I really do enjoy the show. What's his name? Titus is always kind of off the wall and fun to watch, but I really love the storyline with his boyfriend and the character that they added there. I like that because Titus is such an out there, over the top character, you know, by nature. Mm-hmm. And having him in a storyline like that, I felt helped ground him enough to make him more believable for me. Again, this isn't a show that plays with, that's supposed to be all that realistic. It's supposed to be kind of crazy and goofy. And it's got more Easter eggs and hidden jokes than most comedies since Arrested Development, quite frankly. But I thought they did a really good job with him. I still don't care for the Carol Kane character very much. I don't know what's happened to Carol Kane for the last few years. I've always loved her. But between this and Gotham, she's kind of lost me.
Like, yeah, it's just too bad for her. It's
like, hey, Carol, could you do like your own voice instead of all these ridiculous, unbelievable accents you're doing on all these shows? You know, even Simca with a more believable voice than the ones you're doing on these shows. That's taxi for the kids out there if you don't know what I'm talking about. Anyway, but I really enjoyed the season. Were there a couple things I didn't care for? I guess. I got tired of the Dong stuff back in season one. They did get into it a little bit again here in season two, but fortunately it didn't take over the story. But the stuff with him and his green card marriage, I kept going, all right, can we move on? Can we move on? You know, I just wasn't really, it's not that I wasn't believing it, I just was tired of it. It's like, hey, it's not really making me laugh anymore. Can we move on to something else?
Yeah, it wasn't that funny.
I like seeing Amy Sedaris because she's just crazy. So it's nice to see her on anything. But you know who I really liked?
Fred Armisen.
You know what? I didn't like Fred Armisen. I could care less about Fred Armisen's character. I don't really like Fred Armisen. I mean, Documentary Now is really brilliant, but other than that, I really don't like him. So I could care less about seeing him on screen than anything, quite frankly. I'm talking about her Jacqueline's rival. I think her name is Deidre Rupsbear. the rival rich person who's always trying to...
Anna Camp.
Yeah, Anna Camp, right, the actress. I love that character because they could make her just purely one-dimensional, the rival who just wants to make Jackie look bad. But I like the fact that she wants her to fight back. She likes the idea that she's scheming against her. She likes the fact that she actually has lost. It's so different. It's so interesting. And mm-hmm. and became much funnier as a result of that.
Go ahead.
the only other thing I wanted to mention was, as far as just weird things about the show in general, the fact that they're still continuing this really bizarre running gag with that robot that we keep seeing every once in a while. Like, for no reason, we'll see this Yuko the robot show up. And you just kind of like stare like, what? Just very strange. But
guess they're going to pay that off later on down the line.
I'm going to say they're not. I'm going to say they're just throwing it in.
It's just going to be something. Okay.
I think it's just in. I don't think they'll be doing anything with it. Oh, I could be wrong. But I'm not, I did like the show a lot. I'm kind of on the fence as whether or not I liked it less or more than season one. It's close. No one really cares about picking one over the other, so I'm not going to pick one over the other, but they're very close.
Well, I enjoyed the season, but more so for the back part where we got into like the deeper stuff with Kimmy and what really happened down in the bunker and how she chose to deal with it once she got out, because that, you know, all that negative stuff can just eat at your soul. And yeah. For her, it just all popped out at once, and that's a real life thing.
Right. Also, the fact that we got to encounter her fellow cult members this season was kind of cool. I don't know which I find funnier. Cindy, the one who is, you know, about to marry the gay guy. Well, and they end up on the TV show with
the cross between Dr. Phil and Dr. Oz.
Yeah, with Jeff Goldblum, which, you know, you got Jeff Goldblum, you got me. Awesome. But the other one, Gretchen, who's the one who just believes everything, who just can't, she has to be a follower no matter what, and she keeps getting sucked into different things. And then, see, I want to talk about someone who's just going to have a payoff, because at the end of that storyline, she's leading her own cult. So I'm kind of curious if that's going to be something bigger and worse in the third season. If she'll become a more full-fledged cult leader at that point. I'm kind of curious where that's going to go. Yeah, I guess, you know what? Maybe after hearing what you said, maybe I would pick season two as a slightly ahead of it, because it dealt with some more emotional issues, because it dealt with some real issues. As far as, like I said, Titus evolving, you know, getting in a real relationship, Kimmy dealing with her emotions or anger and what happened to her in the bunker, and the stuff with her mom, of course, and the stuff with Jackie, and, you know, realizing it's more than just money for probably the first time in her life. So, okay, I have now decided I will give season two a slight edge over season one. So,
all right, I'll persuade you.
I'll blame you for that. All right, I think we've covered Kimmy as much as I can imagine I wanted to. Okay, if we move on to our third and final show?
Yep, I'm ready.
Well, I figured you would be, because I know you're looking forward to talking about this one, because the next show is going to be Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
I was working hard at a New York job, making dough, but it made me blue. One day I was crying a lot, and so I decided to move to West Covina, California. Brand new pals and new career. It happens to be where Josh lives, but that's not why I'm here.
She's the crazy ex-girlfriend.
What? No, I'm not.
She's the crazy ex-girlfriend.
That's a sexist term.
She's the crazy ex-girlfriend.
Can you guys stop singing for just a second?
She's so broken inside.
The situation's a lot more nuanced than that.
C-R-A-Z-Y.
Okay, we get it.
Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Now, I literally just finished binge watching this show this morning.
This should be fresh for you then.
Yeah, I watched episodes, I think, 11 through 17 last night, you know, into the wee hours of the morning, slept for a few hours, and I was having my morning coffee. I put on the finale and watched it the whole way through. Just because I knew we were podcasting about it. And I know that you're a big fan of the show, so I wanted to really be caught up so I could talk about it with you. So, you were watching the show way, way, way before I was. So,
yeah, I actually got turned on to the show by a friend of mine by the name of Lee. And I saw the first episode, and it was one of those things where, like, all right, I am hooked. Because I knew it was a comedy. Just from the CW promos that are on during Flash and Arrow and Legends of Tomorrow. But somehow it had escaped me that it was a musical comedy. And I am one of those that's a sucker for musicals. And I was in from like the first 10 minutes of the show. I was like, I've got to watch this. And this is one of those shows that is easily bingeable watching. Like, you could just sit down, turn it on, and next thing you know, four or five episodes have gone by before you need a break. I love it. I love the songs. I really love the whole season-long arc storyline that goes through it as well. What is your opinion?
I really like the show a lot. I have no problem with musicals. I like many actual classic musicals. Singing in the Rain is one of the greatest movies of all time. Anyone who doesn't know that or hasn't seen it, they have a problem. And as far as TV shows, I've enjoyed when musicals have incorporated themselves in some shows. The infamous Buffy musical episode. I shouldn't say infamous, because
it was good. It was really good.
Infamous for a few people who don't like it. I thought it was fantastic. The musical episode of Scrubs was one of my favorite episodes of Scrubs. There may be some other shows that I probably didn't care for it as much. Now, with this show, when they do a song that I like, when it's funny and I enjoy it, you know, it's fantastic. Does every song knock it out of the park? Number, routine, whatever? For me, no. There are any number I could have done without. Did I really need to sit through watching the Josh Chan boy band number? Oh God, no. I didn't want to sit through that one. And I understand it's a risk you take because it's a very hard thing to do. Because think about going to see like a Broadway musical, and I've seen a number of which are comedies, like say The Producers or The Book of Mormon or something. Or Something Rotten, which is what I saw earlier this year, quite actually. But then count up how many songs are in those, And not even all those are going to be great. I mean, there'll be a few. There's usually like a few huge standout numbers. Then you've got a bunch of decent ones, and you'll probably have one or two maybe they could have cut. Maybe we could have saved 15 minutes here, guys. But how many is that total? 8. 10, something like that.
Yeah, it's a pretty good size. It's not that big of a size considering all the songs that they did throughout the season.
Yeah, think about on a TV show, there were 18 episodes of the show. How many songs must they have done on that? If every episode has at least two or three in it, I'm thinking something like that. So it's a ton. So
yeah,
I'll forgive their batting average not being 1,000. They definitely still have a pretty damn good batting average as far as the songs are concerned. I got hooked into the show once I saw that first episode. Once I saw that opening credit sequence, they got me. I was like, oh, I love this. And then I loved, because I was binging it, so I was watching episode after episode after episode. And I would say the first 5-6 episodes or so, maybe 7. I know at a certain point it doesn't happen, but the first several, they do a thing in the opening of the show where there's then a comment or a look or whatever that links directly to that opening credit sequence.
Right.
They got really
good with going leading into the credits. They got really good at that.
Right. At a certain point, however, I think they said, you know what, we can't keep doing that. We just can't keep coming up with ideas, because then it doesn't really happen anymore. Or if it happens, it's very subtle. But for the most part, it doesn't really happen the way it did the first 6 or 7, which is funny because at a certain point, how many times is someone going to ask, "Who are you?" or "Where'd you come from?" or something like that? Which is kind of what they were doing. I'm like, "Oh, that's very funny." But I really enjoyed that little opening credit sequence. The anime, although I kept wondering at a certain point because with the animation, how they have each character labeled, and I kept looking at it because the character that's Greg is labeled New Buddy. It's like, Buddy? that's a weird label for that character, especially when you get to the end of the season. But even early, I don't never see him that way. But
No, not even in the first episode when...
Right.
Like that, she's using him to get the Josh.
Right, but I really enjoy that little opening credit thing and showing how sometimes it's great to have an opening credit song, and if it's done well, I have no interest in fast forwarding it. And theirs is pretty quick. I mean, it's like 20 something seconds. Chances are you just heard it a few minutes ago if we edited this thing the right way, but. It also, one of my favorite parts of the entire season is that episode much later on when Paula is talking to her husband, Scott. It is Scott, right? And she's finally telling him about all the situations with Rebecca. And then you realize they're doing all the words to the opening credits song. they literally do the entire song. and even the stuff that Rebecca just says, it's like, oh, it's a little bit more nuanced than that.
Yes.
That's a little sexist. All the way up to the husband going, crazy ex-girlfriend. And And I went, oh, that just made me smile. I had to rewind that back. I just really enjoyed that a lot. But yeah, there's definitely, I mean, obviously one of the hooks of the show is going to be the musical numbers. It's interesting. I noticed a few people online when we were talking about it don't care for that very much. And they
savages.
That they watch the show in spite of it. And I was like, that's like, oh, I don't like to be scared, but I like to watch a horror movie. I don't understand, because that's what the show is. But you know what? It's only a couple, I guess, because it's only a couple parts of each episode, so I guess you could skip over it. But let me tell you, you're missing some really good numbers sometimes. Some of them probably do merit fast-forwarding at times, or feels that way, but the lyrics can be so damn clever.
And oh, they're so clever.
They're so clever, and they take chances. They say things which are like, wait, what? I mean, uh-huh. I've learned, when you're watching the songs at least, go back and put the closed captioning on so you don't miss some of those lyrics, because they get as ballsy and risque as anything I've seen in quite some time with some of those lyrics.
Yeah, I think of like Love My Daughter, but not in a weird way, in episode 6, when it's set to a country song.
Yeah, like, but not in a creepy way.
Not in a creepy way, yes.
That's a great one. I adored the UTI song that Greg sings to her towards the end, because the fact is, it's not just that he's singing about her having a UTI, it's the fact he's singing about, you know, the size of his dick. Because as she put it, the capaciousness. I was about to reveal something a bit too personal. I'm not going to say that on this podcast. I'm going to move on. But I had that very same thing happen to me, except I didn't sing a song. Anyway, but I really do enjoy the show. I'm glad I binged it, and I'm looking forward to the second season. It will be a shorter second season. It's only going to be 13 episodes, I think. I think that's kind of the new thing with the CW. Maybe it's mirroring like the cable shows and the Netflix shows and whatever. I do see there being some drawbacks with the show, and I feel I should at least mention them, because I understand especially after powering through them the way I just did, and it all, as you say, being fresh in my mind. Well, first of all, the show takes a big chance, because the main character, Rebecca, I can see how she could put some viewers off, because she can be a mite bit frustrating at times. I mean, on one hand, she's kind of likable, but on the other hand, I can see for some people, she's not. And that can be a problem. I myself would get frustrated with her at times, and I know you're supposed to. And that's reflective on the show, because of how Paula gets very frustrated with her, being in denial and whatever. But, you know, at some points it feels like it does go on a bit longer than you want it to. You want there to be more of an epiphany moment earlier on, or more of a realization. But that's the risk you take with a show like this, when she is someone who, well, it's called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend for a reason, you know? I'm willing to be okay with that. But here's my problem. The person that she's fixated on, Josh Chan, who by all accounts, you know, he's a good looking guy. He's a very nice guy. And by the way, love the fact they go total diverse cast with this show. I love that they did that. Real kudos to them by having the object of her affection be this Filipino guy. So he's a major character, as is his family, the neighbor who ends up playing him. What is the ethnic background of Heather? I'm not even clear. But she's
I don't think it's ever said.
She's at the okay. I'm not sure. She might be biracial. She might be of some sort of Middle Eastern descent. It's never. I don't know if it is made clear. I don't mind it, but I'm just glad she's not just another Caucasian. You know, it's like, oh, let's just make her a redhead. I like that she's definitely something other, something different, a face that we don't get to see necessarily that often on TV compared to others. And she's, oh, by the way, a fucking great character. I think Heather's a fascinating character. I love that character. But back to my problem, Josh Chan. Here's the thing. Rebecca, and yes, I know she's got a couple screws loose because she stopped taking her meds when she came to West Covina, which has always been a concern of mine because I'm realizing, wait, has she been someone who's been on meds and then she hasn't been on her meds this entire season? Because that would explain why she makes and does so many insane things all season long. It's because she's not on her meds.
She dumps them in the first episode.
Oh, boy.
As soon as she gets to the townhouse, as soon as she gets to that condo, townhouse, whatever, she dumps out the medicine.
Yeah. Maybe not the best message to send out there, but, you know, I get it. The problem I'm having is the entire season is this. Because Josh Chan is a lot of things. He's not the brightest guy, though. I actually like the fact that he's not super smart, because I like that they avoided a certain stereotype by doing that. But I kept going, should she be that fixated on this guy who's clearly, from everything I've seen, not as smart as she is? That kept bothering me. Because she seems like she, when she's normal, so smart and so savvy that she wouldn't be so hung up on someone who is not on her similar level intelligence-wise. I mean, she's someone who has to mention she went to Harvard every 5 minutes.
And Yale.
And Yale, right. Where Josh Chan, I don't know where he went. I don't remember where he went. He strikes me as an associate's degree at best kind of a guy. I don't know. So I kind of actually had a bit of a problem throughout the series with that. Because I kept going, he's cute, but really? But... And they do. And speaking of frustrating, and I know it's done on purpose, and I understand it, but oh my God, Greg Serrano's character, who I automatically gravitate to because I'm like, he's the one I most relate to, because I'm like, oh, sarcastic, snarky, smart, whatever, but not doing well in life, sounds like me. But oh my God, does he do so many fucking stupid things? And you're like, oh, you want to reach into the TV and... It's like they had to find someone who does as many frustrating, annoying things as she does at a certain point.
I actually like Greg.
Oh, I really like him. I get so...
You want to strangle him.
Because it's like, oh, dude, it's all right there. And honestly, if he didn't keep following his worst instincts or listening to advice that he shouldn't be, if he could just be himself, which, as we've seen, then they're a perfect couple. But he never allows that to happen. And then instead he has to put on an act or hide or suppress his feelings or emotions. Or he has to have, you know, yet another Three's Company-ish moment where he sees her talking to Josh somewhere and feels, oh, that's it. I mean, yes, he did see them making out. That's a different story. But that's kind of part of the tension of the show, is that characters are going to do that. And you're like, oh, so close. Because that's kind of a running theme with the show with her. It's like, oh, so close. And then you blew it.
Mm-hmm. And if you happen to listen to his singing voice, it should sound familiar if you have kids, is that... He was the voice of Hans in Frozen.
That's right.
The evil guy in Frozen. But let me tell you, I love that character. I love the actor that plays him. And I think that he had, you know, a couple of the better songs throughout the season, especially towards the end where he does the whole snarky, I could have if I wanted to.
Oh, that's cute.
Where he's walking down the street. And, you know, I feel like that mirrors a lot of people's lives there.
I think for me, for him, with his character, the UTI song first and foremost, because that's just the funniest one. The Settle For Me.
Settle For Me, right.
That beautiful number. Because it's just that's like, Settle For Me was one of the songs I saw that I said, I could see that being in a Broadway musical. And that's, so I think that's really actually saying something. A lot of these, no. You know, or some of them are funny, but they're just kind of like throwaway jokes, like having a song about, you know, a text emergency or a text apocalypse or whatever, which was funny, but you know. But Settle for Me is like, okay, that could be in a, that could be totally be in a musical. I could totally see that, and even the way they choreographed it by having it be like a classic Fred Astaire, like Ginger Rogers kind of a sequence in black and white. I thought that one was really beautiful. That was a really good one.
Yeah, at one point I thought they were going for a Broadway style show within a show, down to where the part where they got to the midsummer break, where they had a big number right before the intermission, where they did the Covina Christmas, or the California Christmas.
Oh, I had California Christmas, but
and that's when they took, you know, that's when everybody got into the big song and dance number, and then they took a month off, and they came back for the beach episode.
Oh, I did like the beach episode. That's a good one. What's mm-hmm. What's your favorite episode of the season?
It's hard. It's hard to pick one, but I like the text episode, and I like the Thanksgiving episode where you got the I Give Good Parent song.
Oh, right.
Which was funny, and also episode 13, which was Josh and I Go to Los Angeles, where you get Jap Battle as well. And by the way, that's not a racial insensitive comment. By the way, that's. I think it stands for Jewish American Princess.
Well, you probably, considering I'm technically Jewish, you should just let me say it, that would be okay. the texting, the accidental text one, that's a really good episode. That one's good. I do like that one. I like the beach, going to the beach episode also. That one's pretty solid. I guess so. I don't know. The text one might be my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
It might be. I kind of like everything just going to hell for her. So.
Also, when Rebecca has a realization where she's the villain in her own story.
Oh, yeah, that's great. I love the realization, by the way. But yeah.
It's a fantastic realization, and you got a whole song about it, too.
Well, it's interesting because they kind of try to set up Valencia as being like not just a rival, but like a like a villain. And you realize, but Valencia is right. she caught on to her, and she's right this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, do they ever reform? They even kind of it seems like they kind of redeem Valencia to make her somewhat less annoying. Or horrible a person, and then they throw it back on it. She has a great song too, though. She's talking about
the yoga song.
No, she has two great songs. The yoga song was stuck in my head for a while. I couldn't get it out of my head. You know, but the song when she's talking about how sisters have to stick together,
right?
And she basically insults this in every single female that she comes into contact with. It's so amazingly horrible.
That's also the beach episode.
Yeah, it's the beach episode. I love the beach episode. With the party bus.
The party bus.
But yeah, I mean, I really did enjoy the show. I'm looking forward to whenever the heck it does come back. I think actually it might come back in October. I think it does, yeah.
October 21.
Well, look at you. Has the info at his fingertips. I think I said this online, but I haven't had the chance to say it on a podcast. It's interesting how we already podcast about three. Now it may actually be four CW shows, you know, with the superhero stuff, with Flash and Arrow and Legends of Tomorrow. And now that Supergirl is moving to the CW, she's going to be falling under that umbrella as well. But other than the fact that, why am I a person of a certain age watching all these CW shows? I watched three other CW shows, which I could see making a case for all being better than the superhero shows. Because iZombie, I think, is amazing. I wish that was a show we podcasted about, quite frankly. The 100 is actually a better show than even that. That show, I can't believe people aren't podcasting about that one, that we're not. And now this show. I mean, I might end up watching Jane the Virgin in the next couple of weeks. I keep hearing that's good. And then I'm going to watch the CW from now on. It's going to be crazy.
Yeah, that's a really good – for somehow, some way, this became a good network.
Who knew?
Yeah, I mean, it's quality. You know, there's a lot of work being put into these shows.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not just fly-by-night stuff like you see on Beauty and the Beast. That's an awful show. Don't watch that show.
Right.
you can see the budget in that show. You know, I'm sure these shows have, you know, small budgets too, but there is a lot of work being put into it. They're stretching that dollar.
Yes, they absolutely are. And you know, the way it ought to be, quite frankly. But yeah. I think I watch more shows on the CW than I watch on any of the other broadcast networks. I'm pretty sure.
How can we go through this whole podcast without actually talking about the main actress, Rachel Bloom, who is tremendously talented, and she has a hand in a lot of this show, not just starring, but I think she's like a producer, and she's writing part of the songs.
She created the character.
Right.
I mean, I watched her. She was a part of a panel on a recent episode of Close Up with the Hollywood Reporter, where they had a panel of different that Sunday was a panel of different comedy actresses. So you had one of the people from Broad City and Alice and Jenny and a bunch of other people. And she was there. And I hadn't watched the show yet. So I watched her talk about it before I actually got to watch the show. So it was interesting talking about her, you know, the difference between when you're playing a character that you have that you've created as opposed to something that someone else has written. So yeah, she's an enormous talent. She's had all those great comedy videos that you can find on YouTube. The one about Hanukkah is hysterical. The one about the kid, the bar mitzvah and touching her boobs is, I've watched it more times than a guy should ever admit. For obvious reasons. And, you know, yeah, I, you know, she, with Hayley Atwell, not an Agent Carter anymore. I know she's going to be on some other show, but I don't know what she's going to look like on that. Rachel Bloom might have taken over my current female crush on TV. It's not purely based on how she's built, but that doesn't hurt. But she's an amazing talent, you know. Kudos to her.
Right. She's got, you know, a movie I wouldn't say a movie star voice, but she's got a really good voice and very talented, but she doesn't come across like a movie star, if that makes any sense. Like, she's not glamorous like a movie star, which really helps her character in the end, that they don't glam her up.
Right. It would be weird if they did. But she does have her moments where she is like, oh, she's a very attractive person. You know? Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. I think she's 1,000 times more attractive than Valencia myself, but that's just me.
And I know you have one more song that you like, and that's by the character I'm going to bring up now, which is Paula Proctor, her friend, or her mother figure, mm-hmm. and that's Face Your Fears. I know you love that song.
Oh, the Face Your Fears number. Yeah, that was a great one. That was ridiculous. And you have all these kids singing in a choir holding the giant scissors in front. Oh my god, Face Your Fears. That was a good one. Yeah, she's a really interesting character. Again, does kind of drive me a little crazy towards the end, where the interesting thing about the show is Rebecca's character is the character we meet, and she's, you know, she's the title character, crazy ex-girlfriend. She's got her mental issues. She's thrown away her meds in the first episode and so on. But you kind of notice that everybody's got issues on this show, you know, some a little bit more than others, but Paula certainly has her issues. Their boss certainly has his issues.
Yes. You
know, Greg, they all could probably use a medication or two, quite frankly, or at least therapy. At the very least, they could all use therapy.
Yes, and her mother, too.
It was kind of funny seeing her mother. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the actress's name. It's Tova. What's her last name? I'm not even going to. The fact, because the last thing we just saw her on was The Walking Dead. So yes. It was kind of funny seeing her show up on this. Like, oh, she's not being just kind of a nothing sourpuss kind of a character. She's kind of being this horrible Jewish mother character. And I love that then we get the reveal later on. It's like, she's a much better person than we realize. I love stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And even she gets her own song, so.
Yeah, she does. Yep. All right. Do you feel we can, other than the fact that we're both going to be looking forward to the next season, do you feel we can close the book on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend now?
Yeah, I think we could. Listen, people, you need to watch this show. This is one of those shows that flew under the radar last year that nobody knew about until it hit Netflix. And someone told me, I've told other people, everybody I've told has loved this show, so this is going out wide now, so watch the show. To the tens of our fans.
Yes, our tens of fans. All right, well, I'm glad we were able to come together to talk about three infinitely bingeable shows, each of which you can find on Netflix. And all are less than 20 episodes. So we're not talking about huge commitment here. So we obviously are recommending all three of them. I would also like to recommend that folks check out our Facebook page. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. You can like the page, you can join the page, and then join all the conversations we have there. You can also find us on iTunes as the Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and or review us there. Every rating and review is very much appreciated. I think at this point I don't need to tell you why. And finally, you can also check us out on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at @STVDPodcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. I don't tweet that often, but every once in a while I'll get on a tweeting jag. Maybe if we're watching an award show or something has happened in the news regarding TV or movies. So why not add us? Why not have one more follower? We certainly could use them. And that's about it. Jason, I'm thrilled that you were able to make time to so we could dust off the cobwebs off our respective microphones and get a little podcasting done.
No kidding. Get back in the groove again. Hopefully this is episode 134.
Yeah, because we're going to be recording a few over the next 2 days, I wasn't sure what order I'm going to release them in, but right now we're going to thinking that this is going to be 134, and which means the next time you'll hear me and Jason, that will probably be 135.
Listen, and if it's not, blame Cade.
Yes. Well, if there's anything you didn't like about this podcast, the fact that we still ended up going on way fucking longer than I wanted to. Yeah, just blame Cade, because he ain't going to listen. Who cares? So on that, I'll say goodnight to everybody out there. Goodnight, Cade. And goodnight, Jason.
Goodnight.
I have friends. I definitely have friends. No one can say that I do not have. And I'm super into Dance Dance Revolution.
Girl with mustache.
Boy with Kurt Weinstein.
Janitor who lives in an RV behind the school.
I have friends. I definitely have friends.
Oh, yeah. I have friends. I definitely have friends. Objectively, I can say that I have all the friends.
I have friends. I definitely have friends. Friends, friends, friendly friends. Time to meet my friends.
I'm Paula.
Daryl.
Lady who hit your car.
Friend of friend from law school.
Grocery clerk with half an eyelid.
We have friends. We definitely have friends. No one can say that we do not have friends.
We have friends. We